critical of the Muslim Brotherhood and the president, Mohamed Morsi. In Egypt, journalists face jail time if they are perceived to insult the president. The detention was quickly condemned by political activists, journalists, and intellectuals as a sharp escalation by the Brotherhood to silence its critics. Another well-known television personality will appear in court on September 1st on charges of inciting violence against the president. Reached by phone in detention, Hafifi said that freedom of speech is threatened in Egypt under this democratically elected president. Leila Fadel, NPR News, Cairo.
France says it's starting a new push to end the death penalty worldwide, and it will be a top priority for French diplomats. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square. This Saturday is August's Art at the Market event, featuring a workshop with the Idea Store and a performance by the Aduro Trio. Information online at urbanailinois.us/artworkshops.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
In the first hour of the program today, we'll talk about the challenges involved in balancing the individual's right to privacy with the country's need for security. And our guest for the program is Daniel Soloff. He is an internationally known expert on privacy law. He's a member of the faculty at the George Washington University Law School. And we'll be talking about some of what you will find in a book that he's authored. The title is Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. The book is published by the Yale University Press and takes its title from the kind of argument that we often hear, that argument that says that people shouldn't worry about the government conducting surveillance if, in fact, they have nothing to hide. He argues that the problem with that is that it takes a much too narrow view of the idea of privacy. He argues that there are good reasons that law-abiding citizens might want to maintain privacy about things that are not potentially embarrassing or are evidence of commission of some kind of crime. In fact, he also argues that there is a way in which we need to preserve the individual right to privacy as a larger kind of social value. That is, it has benefits not just for the individuals, but for all of society. And Professor Soloff, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
Good.
Good. Well, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it. Just the place that you do start is with this this argument. And as you note, people do often make that argument when we talk about the business of security, national security, individual rights. They do then make that argument that says, well, if you haven't done anything wrong, you should have nothing to hide. It seems, though, an easy one to shoot down, at least from the start, if you draw it to the absurd conclusion and you find out, well, in fact, yes, people do have things to hide. What, though, really is wrong with that nothing to hide argument?
Well, the real problem with it is that it understands privacy in too narrow a way. And so just pointing out some embarrassing things or discreditable things that people want to hide, I think, really misses the really pernicious part of the nothing to hide argument. And that's that it neglects a lot of problems with privacy that government surveillance and information gathering can create. For example, one of the major problems with government surveillance and information gathering is a problem that I call exclusion, which is shutting people out of any knowledge or participation of the information gathered about them. And this results in the fact that decisions might be made about a person's life affecting a person, and then the person has no awareness of these decisions, how they're being made. There's no transparency, and the person has no ability to participate in the process to raise objections, to say, hey, I think you're making bad judgments about me, et cetera. That problem about people being kind of shut out of this very important process involving their own lives is a problem that really isn't about hiding anything. It's not about nothing to hide. It's a larger problem involving the way that information about them is used. There are other problems. Another one is secondary use. This is a problem where information gathered for one purpose might be used later on for another purpose. And one of the problems is that the downstream uses of information could be infinite. They could be incredibly vast. And one day the government uses it for one purpose, and people might be fine with that purpose. But then 5 years later, it might be used for a different purpose. And that purpose might be one that people might not particularly like. And so we want accountability on the part of the government and some limitation about how that information can be used down the line. And this is another issue that really isn't about hiding anything. Time and again, and there's many other problems I could mention, the problems of privacy are not always about hiding anything. And even if you have nothing embarrassing to hide, and you're not embarrassed about the products you buy or the books you read or the things you do, nevertheless, there's still a very important component of freedom. And that's not having to justify what you do, what you read, what your activities are to the government. Not have to worry about how someone, some bureaucrat, is going to judge you based on these activities and these purchases that you're making. Because you might be completely innocent, but someone watching what you're doing might have questions or might have suspicions. And I think a real hallmark of being in a free society is not having to worry about the person who's looking over your shoulder from a distance and trying to explain to them, don't worry about this book. I bought it for this reason. Mm. We shouldn't have to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that also helps to address another kind of response that you raise, and that is that some people would say, well, what we're really talking about here, yes, we're talking about the government collecting and keeping information, but it's the government we're talking about, and the government is not going to make that information public. Nobody else is going to see it. So that somehow there's this idea that the government is, well, at the same time collecting information, they're also protecting it.
Well, the government doesn't have a particularly great track record of keeping information confidential. There's been a number of instances where the government has, through carelessness or sometimes deliberately, disclosed confidential information that it maintains about people. And so every time you have data that's stored in any capacity, there's a risk that it might leak out, either through a data security breach or through an official who is abusing the system or someone who's just curious, snooping around. But you have a lot of ways in which that information could, in fact, be disclosed down the line. So when the government gathers it, it doesn't mean that the government is going to guard it with the utmost security. Oftentimes, that's not the case. And the security and protections on that information are rather minimal. And so I think there is a risk that it could leak out. But even if it doesn't leak out, I still think there are major problems with the government information gathering, even if the government never discloses it to anyone.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about something else, and this is another one of those things that people will say in addition to the nothing-to-hide argument, and that's something that you call the all-or-nothing fallacy, and that is that people will say, or one could imagine someone saying, well, I know that I'm giving something up here, but what I'm doing is sacrificing some of my privacy rights in order that I and everyone is more secure. And they're saying, well, if that's the trade-off that I have to make, then I'm going to make it.
Well, I think that's a false trade-off, and that's really one of the central arguments in my book. There's often this view that, well, if we give up privacy, we'll get security. That privacy is this big, heavy thing in the boat, and if you throw it off, suddenly the boat will stop sinking. But that isn't necessarily the case, that privacy isn't related to security in that manner. When it often is the case that I hear people talk about privacy and security or analyzing a particular security measure, you know, should we have this, should the government be able to search this particular thing or that particular thing? Should the government be able to gather this data or whatever? The argument is often always cast as, you know, should it be, should the government be able to do this, or shouldn't the government be able to do this? But in the law, that's not what privacy involves. Privacy rarely involves banning a particular government security measure. And so if we, and I read poll questions that often ask, like after the NSA surveillance program got disclosed to the public, which is when the NSA was secretly listening in on people's phone calls without a warrant or probable cause. Pollsters asked, well, you know, do you want the government to listen in on your phone calls if it'll prevent terrorism? And most people said yes. But that's the wrong question, because protecting privacy in that context doesn't mean that you stop the NSA from listening in on phone calls and that the government's never allowed to listen into a phone call. Protecting privacy means making the government make a justification for when it needs to listen into a phone call, that it can't just listen into a phone call in its unfettered discretion, but it has to actually justify it, putting limitations and having judicial oversight over when and how the government may do this, and essentially regulating it and having it with oversight and accountability, or leaving it entirely to the unchecked discretion of government officials. And that's really the choice that we face. So protecting privacy rarely means scrapping a security measure or stopping a security measure. It just means putting in oversight and accountability and certain protections when the government engages in that particular form of information gathering or surveillance. And so it shouldn't be the case, and we shouldn't be asking, do you want this security measure or do you want that security measure? We really should be asking, do you want this security measure with judicial oversight and certain kinds of regulation, or do you want this the government to be able to do this without any kind of oversight or restriction at all? Mm-hmm. And I think if we look at that question, would you rather have the NSA engaging in surveillance with a warrant or court order or without any kind of judicial oversight, I think most people then would say, well, I kind of want the oversight. The oversight's a valuable thing. But that's what privacy is, and it's not an all-or-nothing trade-off between privacy and security. In all these instances, the government can engage in its security measure. It's just that it's engaging it in a way with oversight and accountability, and that's, I think, a much, much better option than when the government's engaging in it without that accountability and oversight. And so I think if we understand the debate correctly and get rid of this all-or-nothing fallacy, I think we come to a much more sensible way of analyzing how we should protect privacy and protect security at the same time.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Daniel Solov. He is John Marshall Harlan Research Professor of Law at George Washington University Law School, and he is an internationally known expert in privacy law. His most recent book is Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security, and it's published by the Yale University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you about another kind of thing that people say that you also deal with, and I suppose there be some people who might say, well, yes, indeed, the pendulum has swung a little too far to one side here as we talk about this business of security and individual rights. But then they might go on to say, but we have, particularly in the post-9/11 era, we have unusual circumstances here and a pressing need. And they would say something like, if the pendulum has swung a little bit too far, well, we can fix that, that perhaps need made that swing necessary at that time, but we can always grab the pendulum and pull it back more towards the middle position. So what evidence is there, though, that suggests that once you've put something into place that has to do with security and individual rights, that later it gets undone?
Well, I think that this is an argument that I call the pendulum argument, which is, well, don't worry, because in times of crisis, you know, the pendulum naturally swings toward more restriction on liberty and privacy, but in peacetime it'll swing back again. Well, it's not so clear it always swings back the same way or as much. But even if it does, we still have major problems and major harms caused to people when the pendulum has swung. And so an example might be, you know, look at the Japanese internment in World War II. We interned almost, I think, about 100,000 people and took away their liberty for years. It doesn't really do them any favors to say, oh, well, the pendulum's going to swing back. Don't worry. You know, in a few years, you know, you'll have your freedom and we'll apologize. I think that the whole point of having liberties and rights is that in times of crisis, that is what keeps us in check. It's in times of crisis where we're most likely to want to overreact and do rash things because we're afraid. But that's where it's most important to have rights and protections, because that's where we're most likely to, in fact, overreach and harm people and do things that are unwise. And so, you know, rights are much less important when, you know, when we're all at peace and no one's afraid and people are thinking a lot more sensibly and in a lot more of a calm way. We most need rights at the moments of crisis, exactly when the people who argue about the pendulum say, oh, well, let the pendulum swing and it'll swing back. Well, I actually think that the whole point about having rights is that to stop the pendulum from swinging away in the times of crisis.
Yeah. This conversation about rights really always seems to come down to the individual rights, my right, your right. But you also make the argument that there is a larger frame to look at this in, and that you can think of the individual right to also the fact that all individuals in society have the right, the individual privacy right, is good for the group as well. So one shouldn't just think of this simply as a matter of an individual and his or her rights.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I often hear the debate and where the way people cast privacy and security is this particular person's rights versus security of society. And in any kind of balance, society is going to win over one particular individual. And even in the law, we have this notion. In the Fourth Amendment, which is the part of the Constitution that protects against police surveillance and searches, if the government searches another person's property, but that property has your information or your things in it. So, you know, if the government, if I'm walking along with a friend and a friend has some of my papers and my diary and my other information in something that they're carrying in their suitcase, for example, and the police search that, that person has the rights belong to that particular person, not to me. And the idea, it's a very individualistic conception of who has the right to certain things. And so even if the police do a search that is invalid, I don't have standing to challenge that search because the search wasn't of me. But I think that we need to understand things in a different way, that privacy is about a societal value protecting all of us, and we shouldn't focus so narrowly on the particular individual. Because in any instance, the particular individual's interests are going to be much smaller than the larger society's interests. And so I think if we see privacy as a societal interest, then we can appropriately balance it against security, which is also a societal interest. But we need to cast each of the interests on the same playing field and see that the value of protecting privacy is not just protecting that particular person, but it's protecting the privacy of everyone. It's making the government accountable for its searches. It's limiting the power of the government to engage in abuses. It's making sure that when the government does certain things, it has the appropriate oversight and it doesn't go too far in what it's doing. All these are social values, not just individual protections. Mm.
Well, just to pick up on that for a moment, because we have been talking about individual rights and the consequences of those being sacrificed, but there's another level here, and you also deal with it in a book, and you just touched on it, that people have argued that there's something else that has happened here in our concerns about secrecy And who gets to protect what kind of information, in the interest of national security, we have gone some way into making government less transparent, which is also arguably not a good thing, and that there are some people who argue that there is a lot of stuff that's secret that really doesn't need to be, that shouldn't be, and that that also these concerns with security have really argued against openness in have worked against openness in government.
Absolutely. I think that that's a really big problem. I think that right now the government overclaims on the need for secrecy, and as a result, we really don't have adequate transparency of the government. If we're living in a democracy where the people are sovereign, where the people are the boss, it's really hard to be the boss if you have no idea what the government's doing. And there's no way to see if the government is, in fact, acting appropriately in its activities. Of course, we need some degree of government secrecy to carry certain things out. That is certainly a very practical thing. The issue is how much government secrecy, and I think that right now the government will often just say, oh, keep it secret, this is a national security, and it can slap the label up, and courts are incredibly deferential to the government. But often it's the case that the government is like the boy who cried wolf. And what we see later on are in a lot of cases where the government claimed national security, the claim was really covering up certain unsavory and discreditable information about how the government was performing. We see this time and again. I think that courts need to be a lot less deferential to the government's claims. And I also think there needs to be a penalty for falsely claiming national security when there isn't national security issues at stake, because we really don't want a situation where it becomes like the boy who cried wolf, where if the government says, we need to keep this secret, and then no one will ever trust that statement by the government because they've lied so many times in the past about the need for secrecy. And so I think we really need to reform the way that we deal with this, have a lot less deference, and a little bit of a sting to the government if it makes false claims of national security, which in the past it has done time and again.
Mm-hmm. You know, right from the first, after 9/11, people were looking at the way that the government responded and saying there were really two possibilities here for how we think about that act and then how we responded. One way would be the way that we did, to label that an act of war, which leads you then to think and behave in certain ways. There are other people who argued, said, no, that was a mistake. That's not what this is. And that what we should do is we should think of this as a crime and respond to it as a crime and go down that path. Well, that's not the path that we took. But are there some ways in which the decision that was made to think of this as an act of war has implications for this business of how we think about security and individual rights?
Well, I definitely think it has implications because the law gets very different when you're dealing with crime versus when you're dealing with what is basically international espionage. Mm-hmm. Or spying. Mm-hmm. is the typical distinction the law makes. And waging of warfare. And they're two very different legal regimes when it comes to these things. I think that when we're waging a war abroad, there needs to be a lot more leeway, and the laws that govern crime don't make a lot of sense in some of those contexts. You know, if we believe that there's a foreign spy on U.S. soil who's spying on us, we need the ability to engage in surveillance of that foreign spy, and that surveillance, the laws that deal with investigation of crime might not readily apply to that situation involving the spy because the spy might not be engaged in any particular crime other than the spying, and so it might be hard to justify the need for that. So there's a whole separate law dealing with foreign spies and with foreign agents. The difficulty is terrorism kind of falls in this gray area between crime and foreign spying and other foreign activity and war. And it's very hard to classify what is terrorism. Is it one thing or the other? And it's kind of both. The problem gets especially acute when it involves American citizens who are engaging in this activity. And in those cases, the government has often, at least sometimes, said, no, we're going to treat you like a foreigner, and we're going to treat you like a foreign spy with that set of rules. That's a big problem, because how do we determine what the difference between a crime and terrorism is? So many years ago, there was a sniper, actually two people, who were going around shooting people in the Washington, D.C. area. Isn't that kind of like a form of terrorism? Timothy McVeigh, is that terrorism? Is that a crime? A lot of things are... it's very, very hard to make this distinction. And I think when American citizens are involved, the regime that regulates the foreign spying and the waging of war has very minimal protections for privacy and civil liberties. And I think it's very scary to wipe away those protections by just labeling something a war and throwing it into this other regime. And so that's why I think we should be very careful about how we classify things, especially when it involves American citizens.
Well, and was certainly that there certainly was a lot of criticism of the Bush administration for, generally speaking, taking a very expansive view of executive power. But in this particular case, I think that, and again, this perhaps goes back to the war metaphor. I think the administration said, well, we're at war, and that that the administration is essentially should be unrestricted in how it responds.
Yeah, I found that argument to be way overbroad in the way the administration made it. But essentially, they made the argument there was a law that actually restricted the kind of surveillance that the government could do. It actually was a law that called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The NSA surveillance program that the Bush administration implemented after 9/11 was a clear violation of the law. Really no ifs, ands, or buts. It's about most legal questions are ambiguous. This question was clear. This was a violation of that law. So what the Bush administration argued was, well, we're waging a war, and the government has the power to wage a war, and therefore we can disregard any law that we want in the pursuit of war, because we have this war power, and that overrides any law. The problem with the argument is it gives the government absolute powers akin to a dictator. Government, the president could say, look, I can disregard the law of murder, I can just shoot someone in the head if it's in the war on terror. The other problem is it's not clear with the war on terror if this war has any end. Is there an end to the war on terror? There's always going to be some terrorist out there who is going to potentially be a threat to this country. That means we're essentially going to be at war forever. And then the government has these unchecked powers that are to basically disregard any law that the president sees fit. That, to me, is giving the executive the power of a dictator, which is exactly the thing that our system of government is trying to stop. One of the hallmarks of our democracy is the rule of law, that all government officials have to follow the law, that no one is above the law, even the president. In certain despotic regimes, the ruler routinely violates the law. I mean, that's sort of, they are the law, essentially. They do what they want. Stalin and the Soviet Union and Saddam Hussein in Iraq and Gaddafi in Libya, these are the kind of people who have to act above the law. But that's not our system. In our system, everyone, even the president, must be constrained by the law. But unfortunately, the way that the Bush administration made its argument, it basically said, no, the rule of law doesn't really apply to us. I think that is incredibly irresponsible, incredibly frightening, and incredibly problematic. And I really don't think that there was enough pushback on outrage over what he was saying and proposing. It was a fundamental challenge to our very democracy, and I think it was a real outrageous claim of power.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Daniel Solov. He's professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. He's an internationally known expert on privacy law. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 51 years of service to music education. The Music Shop serves over 200 school music programs with band and orchestra instruments, a large sheet music department, thousands of accessories, and private lessons at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
The guest in this hour of Focus is Daniel Solov. He is John Marshall Harlan Research Professor of Law at George Washington University Law School. He's written a number of books about information privacy, including The Future of Reputation, Gossip, Rumor, and Privacy on the Internet. That was published by the Yale University Press. And a new one that we're talking about this morning, the title of this book is Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. And it is also published by the Yale University Press. And we have some callers here. We'll go to the first in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Apropos what you were just talking about before the break of the Bush administration arrogating this power to itself under the name of war, the ACLU has an action alert out today concerning the Defense Authorization Bill 1867 that is titled, Senators Demand the Military Lock Up American Citizens in the, quote, battlefield, they defined as being right outside your window. So basically, it sounds like the article is fairly lengthy, but Senator Udall has an amendment that would strip this from the defense authorization bills, but I just heard there are about 100 amendments, and I don't know what number that amendment is. But so basically, this is legalizing what the Bush administration arrogated, and it's outrageous. And I urge people to call their senators or something. I assume it's already passed in the House. Apropos the electronics dimension, which is mainly what you're considering, I always like to bring up the fact that a lot of data mining and all this stuff is being contracted out, as well as we have military contractors and clandestine contractors, but we also have a lot of this stuff being done by SAIC, Booz Allen, all sorts of other agencies. So that's a dimension I'd like for you to comment on, because it's extremely pernicious. It's bad enough when the government is doing this, but if there's corporate involvement, there's less oversight than there is even in the way things, quote, ought to be set up. I guess I'll sign off and listen. Thanks.
All right.
Well, that's a very good point, and it is a big problem, this increasing connection between the government and the private sector when it comes to surveillance. The government does outsource a lot of data mining and activities to the private sector, and I do think it's a tremendous problem generally. I think what facilitates it is that we have, I think, a very bad set of judicial decisions and laws that regulate the sharing of information between the private sector and the government. Basically, under the Fourth Amendment, the government can access data from the private sector with very, very minimal protections. The Fourth Amendment generally does not apply when the government seeks to access information from the private sector. There's very little restriction when the government seeks to find find a cooperating company to perform data mining and provide it with information. So I think that what we really need is a better set of laws that would create the appropriate set of protections to make sure that the data doesn't flow so readily and that there's adequate oversight and accountability in this process. That's really ultimately what is going on now, and is that there's a tremendous amount of government information gathering done by the government and by the private sector in the government's on the government's behalf or for the government, with very little oversight and accountability and transparency, which I think is a very, very big problem. And so we really need to fix this in the law, but unfortunately there hasn't been much of a push by legislatures to do this. Congress doesn't seem interested, and the president doesn't seem interested, unfortunately. And the Supreme Court, in the way it interprets the Fourth Amendment, doesn't seem interested. So I hope one day there'll be the appropriate set of legal protections for all this. But right now, I wouldn't call it the Wild West, but it's awfully close.
Yeah. I have an email from here, someone who I think is on the same track, who writes, during 20 years of working in information technology, I watched the industry move from its flailing toddler days where it barely managed small amounts of data to what I would call the teenage indiscretion stage, where now it has huge amounts of data, sort of knows what to do with it, and is struggling to learn to drive well. I like the metaphor. She goes on, I believe we're at a critical stage where we can prevent the assumption that data belongs to corporations and those who hold it for individuals. Why can't we get our government to understand that it needs to protect individual privacy by default? And she goes on to ask, besides guarding our data carefully and refusing to allow it to be captured where we can, what can we do?
Well, there's not a whole lot the particular individual can do. Ultimately, I do think we really do need legal and policy solutions to these problems. There are certainly little things that people can do, but these are larger problems that really cry out for better law, better judicial decisions, and better legislation. And I really think it's unfortunate that we really don't see much of a push for that. I was hoping that with the Obama administration, there would be an attempt to propose and develop a better regulatory regime for government surveillance and government information gathering, one that was balanced appropriately. And again, as I argue in my book, it's not an all-or-nothing thing. I mean, there's a way that the government can gather this information, but with the appropriate set of oversight and protections. Unfortunately, there really hasn't been much leadership on this issue that I've seen yet from the administration. I think that's unfortunate. I'd love to see something move forward finally on this issue. But I think that, you know, until that happens, we really are in a bad way. And I wish there were something, you know, better news on the horizon or something that people could do. But I really think that when it comes to what the government is doing, I think it's really people need to push for change in this area. And I guess it's very, very hard to do when right now the major issue front and center is the economy. And so this is just something that isn't as salient on a lot of people's radar screens. But I think something, it's a very important issue, and something should be done about it.
Yeah, all right. Let's take another caller. This is someone in Urbana, and this is line two. Hello.
Professor Solov, good morning, and thank you for being with us. David, good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
I was hoping you could comment on, well, your comments before the break. You must have been reading my mind about the malfeasance with the relating to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act under the Bush administration, and it may be digressing a little bit from the spirit of what today's program is about, but I was wondering if you could comment, to your best knowledge, on the continuing role of FISA courts under the Obama administration. Thank you for your time, and I'll hang up and listen to your comments, okay?
Okay.
Well, I mean, to my knowledge, that things have continued on pretty much as they were before, with very little change. To my knowledge, I'm not aware of the Obama administration rolling out any kind of new surveillance program. So, you know, with the Bush administration, it seemed that practically every month we were hearing about some kind of new surveillance or things that they were doing that was problematic. We haven't heard about as much there, but these programs continue. You know, Congress essentially legalized the NSA surveillance program by passing a law that relaxed some of the provisions of FISA to allow the NSA to continue its program with minimal privacy protection. I really haven't seen any, change in direction from, where we were before when it comes to surveillance. The Obama administration is, I think, using all the tools that the Bush administration was using or created. So I believe that, every year there's a report about the number of FISA orders, and they go up. And they've continued on an upward trend year after year after year. And so we're seeing more activity in the FISA courts every year. And I've yet to see, the number being lower from the year before. So it's just increasing and increasing. Mm-hmm.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit less, in this hour of Focus. Again, our guest is Daniel Soloff. He's professor of law at George Washington University Law School. His particular area of interest is privacy law. His new book is Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Yale University Press is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that at least in the past, that people had this expectation of privacy in their personal communications. That is, they thought that if they wrote somebody a letter or if they called somebody on the phone, their letter would not be opened and read and nobody would be listening to their conversation. Now, that may have been a false sense of security, but people at least had that. Now, with the expansion of ways to communicate, are there questions about whether, first of all, what sort of overall protections there are, but are there questions about whether that same expectation of privacy applies to email, text message, cell phone call, all of the various ways in which we're communicating now?
Well, I think that, what people expect to be private and what the Supreme Court actually protects as private are two very, very different things. The court back in 1967 adopted a test for when the Fourth Amendment would regulate police searches and surveillance, and that was when there's a reasonable expectation of privacy in something. The court has basically... The court rarely looks to what society actually expects when it applies this test. It just decides what it thinks, so it never cites any empirical evidence to determine what's a reasonable expectation of privacy. And the court has certain notions of privacy that make it make so many things fall outside of the protections of the Fourth Amendment. And so despite the fact that people might expect privacy in their communications, in their web surfing, and a lot of other things, it doesn't necessarily mean that there are going to be any kind of protections against those type of things. I actually think that looking for expectations of privacy is actually the wrong approach for the Supreme Court to take. I used to think, well, if the court just had a better understanding of privacy, it would work well. And now I think that asking is there an expectation of privacy in something is the wrong question. I think we should ask for whether or not we want to regulate with the Fourth Amendment certain kinds of government searches and surveillance. We should ask, is this the kind of government search or surveillance where we want judicial oversight and we want the government to have to justify to a court what it's doing before it engages in this kind of search? And if we want that oversight, then I think then we should apply the Fourth Amendment and have that oversight. We might want the oversight because we want to protect privacy. We might want the oversight because we think that the information the government's gathering will make it too powerful, or that there's a potential for abuse, or that there are dangers if the government isn't accountable, or there are dangers if the government doesn't have to justify why it needs to do this. And I think all those reasons may be privacy, they may be something else, but I don't think that the law should turn on the vagaries of some notion of privacy that the court has or anyone else has. I think it should turn on whether or not we want to regulate this particular government activity or not. And I think if we look at it that way, I think we see a lot of things that fall outside of some notion of privacy, but nevertheless are tremendously problematic exercises of government power that we should be regulating.
Just this is slightly different, but certainly connects. I don't know how much people are aware of it, but I think we're increasingly becoming aware of the fact that when we're in public places, people are watching us in the form of all kinds of cameras that belong to either private or public interests. We see places like London, for example, which I think is the place where there are more security cameras outside watching people as they're walking down the street than any other place in the world, maybe as far as anybody knows. But the question I'm interested in is there, when you are in public walking down the street, do you have any, is there any expectation that you have privacy, or if you are out in public, everything you say and do is completely open? There is no such thing as privacy in that context.
Under the law that regulates government surveillance, under the Fourth Amendment, for example, the court has basically said no. Hmm. There is no expectation of privacy. I don't agree with that. I actually think there is. It's just a question of what is privacy here. If privacy is about total secrecy, then yeah, I mean, people don't expect total secrecy when they're out in public. But they do expect a certain kind of practical obscurity or anonymity when they're in public. The fact is that I'm not expecting, when I'm walking in public, for someone to be tracking me 24/7 wherever I'm moving. I don't expect someone to be watching me on a camera wherever I go. If I go to a store and buy certain things, I don't expect the store clerk to remember who I am or even to know who I am or to remember what I bought. If I'm at a restaurant, I don't expect other people to be listening in on my conversation. We go about our lives with, I think, an expectation of obscurity when we're in public. And the problem is that modern technology can destroy that kind of obscurity by recording every little thing that goes on while people are in public. But that, I think, creates some problems because a lot of our conversations, private conversations, occur in public as we're walking down the street or in a restaurant or wherever or in a taxi cab. A lot of the things that we do that we don't want people to track and know about, things I buy in a store, et cetera, all that, are things that I think we want to preserve the ability to be out in public and not be traced and have everything recorded. I think that's a kind of scary world to live in and an undesirable place to live in, where, you know, wherever we go and whatever we do in public is recorded. And the only sanctuary is in, you know, the dark corners of our homes.
It seems that the part of that, this gets complicated because people willingly participate in systems that make it possible for them to be tracked. I mean, so many people are carrying pocket-sized devices, and they willingly allow themselves to be tracked, or at least it's something that they allow to be there. I've heard people talk about how now particularly younger people who have grown up with these kinds of information technologies are going to have a radically different idea of privacy and what it is than you and I and our parents and going back did. Do you think that is the case, that there's a certain momentum here that the technology makes possible that's going to be hard to resist?
Well, I mean, I think that the technology might make certain things possible, but that doesn't mean that they're desirable or that the law should allow them to be engaged in an unfettered way. That a lot of technology will give us tremendous power, but that doesn't mean that we would say that, you know, just because my car can go up to 140 miles an hour doesn't mean I should be driving it at 140 miles an hour. So just because something, you know, has the capacity to do something doesn't mean that we should allow it under the law. So I think that, you know, tracking people and where they go is something that the government should be allowed to do if it has the appropriate court order, a warrant and probable cause, the appropriate justification to do it. There are certain times where we want the government to track people down. If someone's been kidnapped, I think that's a good chance, a good opportunity or a good reason to, you know, track them. But I think just generally tracking where everyone goes and seeing where they go is something the law should be restrictive of. And so I think that it's really about the proper control over technology. Of, you know, technology makes certain things possible, but the whole point about law is to provide those protections to make it hard for people to engage in certain kinds of problematic behaviors. You know, it's very easy to, you know, forge a check. It's very easy to engage in credit card fraud and just take someone's credit card number and do it. But we have laws that make that illegal, and we want to stop that.
Yeah, we'll have to leave it at that. Our guest is Daniel Solov. He's professor of law at George Washington University Law School. His book is Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
President Obama opposed the Citizens United decision that created super PACs, but super PACs are where the big money is. The president also has a reputation for not sufficiently stroking major donors. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jane Mayer about her article on Obama's fundraising problems called Schmooze or Lose. It's published in the current New Yorker. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, with beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, and for those with or recovering from cancer. New classes start the week of August 27th. Details at yoga-cu.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets as we head into the last several hours of trade for this Thursday. Corn futures, which were in positive territory at one point today, have since slid into double-digit losses as the export sales report this morning was deemed extremely disappointing for both old crop and new crop sales. Corn futures under pressure as foreign buyers are foregoing U.S. corn to buy other grains. Overnight, Japan actually purchased feed wheat and feed barley in a tender and not U.S. corn. There's also some greater interest in South American corn. In fact, we're even seeing reports of South American corn from Argentina now beginning to enter the U.S. on the East Coast. Corn sent from Brazil to China is also being offered right now at an 85-cent discount to U.S. corn. And Argentina corn to China is a $1.05 discount to U.S. corn right now. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. We'll begin in that corn pit where September's at 814 and a half, down 15 and three quarters. December,